was the 21st of December, 1908, in Glasgow's Square Mile of Murder. At 7 p.m., a young maid, Helen Nellie Lambie, left the flat where she worked for Marion Gilchrist, leaving her 83-year-old mistress in the flat at 15 Queen's Terrace, West Princes Street. Nellie left every day at 7 p.m. to fetch the newspapers for Miss Gilchrist, a task that usually took her 10 minutes. It was during this short period of time that Nellie Lambie was running errands that her wealthy employer was murdered, and an injustice of historic proportions was set into motion. But we'll get to all that. This is Square Mile of Murder, and today we're covering the final case from our namesake, the murder of Marion Gilchrist and the trial of Oscar Slater. I'm Taylor.
I'm Kat. Before we get to Oscar Slater, let's rewind a bit to when Nellie Lambie leaves the flat. Miss Marion Gilchrist was a wealthy, unmarried woman living in a well-appointed first-floor flat at 49 West Princes Street, which is now in an area of Glasgow called Woodlands. This is the furthest west that we've seen in the Square Mile of Murder, and now falls on the opposite side of the motorway that was built through the centre of the area. Living below Miss Gilchrist in the main door flat on the ground floor was Mr. Arthur Adams and his two sisters. Adams heard a thud on the ceiling of his dining room, followed by three taps, which was a prearranged signal between him and Miss Gilchrist. If she was ever in trouble, they agreed she should tap on the floor and Adams would come up to help at once.
Very kind.
Yeah.
So he and his sisters were pretty sure that those three taps were definitely the signal. And so Adams went out his front door and went through the closed door that led to the stairs up to Miss Gilchrist's flat. And it also led to one unoccupied flat up on the second floor, so one floor above her. And he was surprised to find the closed door unlocked, because it was usually kept locked. He continued on and reached Miss Gilchrist's door and rang the bell. He got no response, and he couldn't hear anything inside, so he rang again. He looked through the glass panels on either side of the door and saw that the gas lights were lit in the entryway. So he rang one more time, and then he heard what he thought sounded like someone chopping sticks, and he assumed that this was Nellie in the kitchen. So he went back downstairs.
But his sister, Laura Adams, was not satisfied with her brother's investigations and was convinced something was wrong upstairs. She sent him back upstairs where he rang again. This time it was completely silent. He heard someone coming up the stairs behind him and saw Nellie Lambie returning from her errands. He told her what he had heard and she said the noises were probably some pulleys in the kitchen that needed oiling. Nonetheless, he said he'd stay put until he was sure everything was all right. Nellie unlocked two of the three locks on the door, because the third lock was only ever locked on a night, and headed towards the kitchen to check the pulleys. Arthur Adams could see into the entryway, which had two doors on the right and two doors on the left. As Nellie headed left to the kitchen, a man appeared from one of the bedroom doors on the right. The man wore a light overcoat, and Adams later said the man looked to be a quote-unquote gentleman. This mysterious man stepped up to Adams almost as if to speak to him, but instead stepped past him, over the threshold, and disappeared quickly down the stairs. Adams noted that Nellie Lambie didn't seem surprised to see this man and assumed she must have known him.
Nellie continued on to the kitchen, where she reported that nothing was wrong with the pulleys. But Adams was more concerned that Miss Gilchrist was nowhere to be seen. Nellie went into the dining room and let out an awful scream. She called out, "Oh, come here!" Adams followed her and saw Miss Marion Gilchrist lying on the floor in front of the fireplace. She had a rug thrown over her head and was surrounded by blood. Upon seeing this gruesome sight, he decided to go after the mystery man. He told Nellie to go to the closed door and stay there until he got back. He sprinted down the stairs and into the street. He ran in both directions, but couldn't find the man from the close. When he returned, Nellie Lambie had found a policeman. So they all went back into the dining room and removed the rug from Miss Gilchrist. They saw that she had been beaten savagely around her head, but she was still breathing. Arthur Adams ran out to fetch a doctor from across the street. When the doctor arrived, though, Miss Gilchrist had died. The doctor pointed out that a bloodstained chair next to the body looked to be the murder weapon. And this is the last that we'll hear from the doctor in this case. He was never questioned, nor did he appear at the trial that would follow.
That's always a good sign.
Isn't it just?
As the police started to look around the flat, they found a lit gas lamp in the spare bedroom that Nellie swore hadn't been lit when she left. Below the lamp was a used match and a box of Runaway brand matches, a brand that Lambie said they did not use in the house. She had never seen them before. On the table beside the matches was a gold watch and chain, a tray with some jewellery, and a wooden box holding documents that had been broken open and clearly rifled through. Papers were strewn all over the floor. When asked if anything was missing from the room, Nellie could only come up with one thing. A crescent-shaped diamond brooch. When police asked Nellie and Adams to describe the man who had exited the flat, they found their witnesses to be less than helpful. Nellie said she had barely seen the man, and Arthur Adams had left his glasses downstairs and hadn't got a good look at the man. Well, that's not good.
No. You know, maybe put your glasses on, man.
What help is he going to, was he going to be to her if she was in trouble without his glasses?
No glasses? I don't know. So the description that the police cobbled together was this. A man between 25 and 30 years of age, 5 feet 8 or 9 inches in height, slim build, dark hair, clean shaven, dressed in a light gray overcoat and dark cloth cap, cannot be further described. Like, great, okay.
That's not a bad description for someone you barely got a look at.
No, it's not. I just love that they felt the need to put in there. It's like, that's all we got, guys. This is it.
But you already have, like, the question of whether or not it's accurate.
Yes, exactly. So they sent this description to pawn shops around the city, along with information about the stolen crescent brooch. Nellie, for her part, left the flat that night to tell Miss Gilchrist's niece, Miss Margaret Beryl, about the murder. Police believed that the murderer was someone whom Miss Gilchrist knew, or was at least familiar enough with to let him into her house. They were immediately suspicious of Nellie Lambie and looked into her boyfriend's and if she had told anyone about the jewelry in the flat. See, Miss Gilchrist was laden with jewels, and rumor had it she secreted expensive pieces of jewelry all over the flat and may have even sewed some into the linings of her curtains. I mean, it's a good way to keep the curtains closed. Keep the heat
or
in.
Keep them weighted down.
Yeah. She apparently had over 3,000 pounds worth of jewelry hidden around the flat. And that's 3,000 pounds in 1908. So worth a lot more now.
£363,269.16.
That's a lot.
That's
a lot of jewelry. Holy shit. So despite the fact that she had all this jewelry, very expensive, very valuable jewelry hidden around the flat, only the brooch had been taken. And some of the jewelry was just like lying on the, you know, on the table.
Yeah, that's weird.
It is. It is weird. She was also terrified of burglars and intruders, which was why she had set up the signal with the Adams family downstairs. So All of this points to the idea that she wouldn't let just anybody into her home.
By Christmas Eve, the police still didn't have any leads, but they looked into some information in the form of an eyewitness. 14-year-old Mary Barrowman told police after some convincing by her mother that she had been walking along West Prince's Street at 7:10 on December 21st and had seen a man rush from Miss Gilchrist's close and then dash down the street. She said that the man bumped into her and then turned down West Cumberland Street and disappeared. Her description of this man was much more detailed, but it also differed wildly from the one given by Nellie Lambie and Arthur Adams. So much so that police decided they were probably looking for two different men. They issued a statement saying that they were looking for the first man who matched the first description, and a second man, aged 28 to 30 years of age, tall and thin, clean-shaven, nose slightly turned to one side, thought to be the right, wore a fawn-coloured overcoat, believed to be a waterproof, dark trousers, tweed cloth cap of the latest make, and believed to be dark in colour, and brown boots. These descriptions were published in Glasgow newspapers on Christmas Day. On Christmas Day, the police also got a tip from a bicycle dealer named Alan McLean. McLean had read about the stolen brooch and told police that another member of a gambling club he belonged to had been trying to sell a pawn ticket for a diamond crescent brooch. He told police he could show them the house that this man lived in, and he only knew the man's first name, Oscar.
Oscar. So, McLean led the police to this address where this Oscar supposedly lived, which was 69 St. George's Road. And there, police found a plate on the door that read A. Anderson, Dentist. But the place definitely wasn't a dentist's office, but instead the residence of one Oscar Slater. Born Oscar Joseph Lessinger in Oppeln, Upper Silesia, Germany, to a Jewish family in 1872. He had left Germany in 1893 and moved to London, where he had worked as a bookmaker using various anglicized names, including Anderson, before settling on Slater as his surname. He moved to Edinburgh in 1899 and then Glasgow in 1901, where he lived with his mistress, Madame Junia Antoni. Oscar Slater billed himself as a dealer of precious stones, but more likely made his living through gambling. Although there's some evidence that he may have been what I kept seeing referenced as, or being called, a resetter of stones, so basically a reseller of stolen goods, but sources differ. but he's definitely a gambler. And Madame Junia entertained men for money in the couple's flat while Oscar was out working. So she was a sex worker. And her professional name was Madame Junia. So, obviously, police were quite pleased to come upon this veritable den of ill repute. But they had a problem. Nobody was home. You see, earlier that day, Oscar Slater and Madame Junia had left Glasgow for Liverpool and had plans to sail to New York on the Lusitania. Police believe this sudden departure must have been a flight from justice. And the descriptions had been published in the newspaper that day, so surely Slater had seen this and realized that he had to get out of town. They had another problem, though.
Of course they did.
Of course they did. So that brooch that Slater had pawned, that McLean had heard about, it wasn't the same brooch that had gone missing from Marion Gilchrist's flat. The brooch pawned by Slater had been pawned way back on November 18th. But the police didn't let the fact that they had no evidence deter them. Quite the contrary, in fact. They became convinced that Oscar Slater was their man.
Police found that Slater and Madame Junior were traveling on the Lusitania under the names Mr. and Mrs. Otto Sandow, and they alerted the New York police. When the ship docked on January 2nd, 1909, Slater was arrested and taken to the Tombs prison. Newspapers back in Glasgow printed Slater's name and photograph and announced he had been arrested for the gruesome murder. The police now had to extradite Slater back to Scotland. But first, they sent their three main witnesses to New York to identify him. Even though Nellie Lambie and Arthur Adams said they wouldn't be able to identify the man they saw, and the man that Mary Barrowman had seen was very different from the man the other two had encountered, they still sent them anyway, all the way across the Atlantic, which, you know, is now a 6-hour flight. Not so much in those days.
No, and also not cheap, I'd imagine.
Yeah.
Like, this part baffles me.
Yeah. I actually didn't know that they sent them to New York.
No.
I knew bits about this case, but not all the details.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, sent them all the way to New York, and they had a plan to solve their different descriptions. They coached Nellie and Mary until their descriptions lined up, and just for good measure, they put the two girls in a cabin together for the 12-day voyage across the ocean.
Pretty smart.
Ah. The three did identify Slater in a New York courtroom after seeing him led down the hallway in handcuffs. But this was also far from perfect. Nellie and Mary reportedly recognized Slater in the hallway, but Arthur Adams had to ask the two girls if the man in handcuffs was the right man. Slater had an American lawyer who advised him to resist extradition. But Slater insisted he was innocent and volunteered to return to Scotland to clear the whole thing up.
So, while waiting in the Tombs, Slater wrote a letter to a friend where he discussed the crime he was accused of. He knew so little about the murder of Marion Gilchrist that he thought the crime had taken place on December 22nd, not the 21st. He had already told police that he had never met Miss Marion Gilchrist and had never been to her house. He also explained the discrepancy between the name on his front door, A. Anderson, and his own name. See, after moving to Glasgow, Slater had met a Scottish woman and the two were married, which turned out to be not so good for Slater, because this woman was an alcoholic who spent money wildly. He had left her, but they didn't get divorced. And he often used different names to keep off her radar when she would come looking for money. Soon after, he met Madame Genia in London, and the two lived together in New York for a few years before returning to Glasgow in 1908. Now, this might be a good time to describe Oscar Slater. He was known to be a well-dressed man who had his shirts custom made. He was very broad-shouldered. He had a prominent nose and wore a small mustache. And now...
He wore a mustache or he grew a mustache?
He grew a mustache. He had a mustache. He wore a mustache. He did it all with his mustache. Now, he is often described as being, quote, distinctly foreign-looking at a time when Glasgow didn't have many foreign-looking residents. All of this is to say that Slater, quote-unquote, looked Jewish at a time when many people in Glasgow, especially the people in Glasgow's upper echelons of society, held fairly anti-Semitic views. Starting in the 1880s, Scotland had seen an increase of Jewish immigrants fleeing from persecution and pogroms in the Russian Empire. Many settled in poor areas of Glasgow like the Gorbals, which was already home to many Irish and Italian immigrants. By 1897, Glasgow had a Jewish population of about 4,000. So, History is fuzzy on just how much anti-Semitism contributed to Slater's identification as the murderer, but it's safe to say that Mary Berryman's description of a man with a large bent nose, or hooked nose as some sources describe it, certainly fits with common anti-Semitic stereotypes. Scholar Ben Braber has written about Slater's case and came to the conclusion that police and court officials were influenced by xenophobia and anti-Jewish sentiment.
Surely not.
No, it couldn't be.
That would never happen.
No.
Not in this wonderful country.
Yeah. We don't have a problem here.
We've been like post-racial for hundreds of years.
Yeah. So add to all of that, Slater's chosen profession as a gambler, and his chances of getting a fair trial were already not looking so good.
So Slater returned to Scotland, where he told police that his trip to New York had been planned at the beginning of December. He had written to his friends in America as early as December 7th about his plans to head out to San Francisco to start a gambling club there. Well, it beats the mob and their plans to open the Flamingo in Las Vegas.
I mean, yes. I'd rather be in San Francisco than Las Vegas any day.
Never been to either, so I can't compare.
One's really hot.
You mean the one that's in the middle of the desert?
Yeah, that one.
He also had an alibi for the night of the murder. Slater spent the afternoon at a billiards club on Renfield Street with two friends. He left there around 9:30 p.m. and returned home to have dinner with Madame Junia and her maid, Catherine Schmaltz. Why do I feel that she didn't get a fair say in it either?
Probably not.
He stayed in his house until 8 when he went down to the close to smoke. A grocer saw Slater smoking and recognized him as a customer, but this grocer was never called at trial. He was also seen gambling at the Sloper Club later that night. Despite this, Slater was picked out at an identity parade by more witnesses who came forward saying they had seen him around West Princes Street the night of the murder. And it's important to make note that they came forward after Slater's picture had been printed in the newspapers. Isn't that convenient?
Isn't it just?
To make matters worse, the other men in the lineup were 9 policemen and 2 railway officials, all of whom were native Scots. And Slater was an obvious odd man out. And so his trial was set for Monday, May 3rd, in Edinburgh.
Now, in the years since this identity parade, it has been used as a teaching example of what not to do.
Yeah, you're not allowed to have... you're not allowed to have one person who is so clearly different.
Yeah, quite clearly.
Or stands out in some way. You have to have everyone who looks...
similar.
Not the same, but at least similar.
Yeah. And like...
because it is... even for the person identifying them... it sets off unconscious bias because they're like, well, they stand out.
Yes, exactly.
So even if you don't remember them, they stand out to you there and then.
Yeah, exactly. So his trial was presided over by Lord Charles John Guthrie, who from the start of the trial made it very clear that he thought Slater was guilty. The prosecution's whole case hinged on eyewitness testimony. On the stand, Arthur Adams was still hesitant about whether Slater was the man he had seen in the flat, but Nellie Lambie and Mary Berryman both testified that they were absolutely sure. The prosecution also hammered what he described as Slater's, quote, flight from justice to New York. But the defense put up witnesses that gave Slater an alibi for the night of the murder, as well as witnesses that confirmed Slater's trip to America was planned well in advance. When the judge addressed the jury, he made sure to emphasize Slater's poor character. He said, quote, "He has maintained himself by the ruin of men and on the ruin of women, living for years past in a way that many blackguards would scorn to live. The man's life has been not only a lie for years, but is so today. We do not know whether he ever did an honest day's work in his life.
Whether or not you've worked a day in your life has no bearing on whether or not you are guilty.
Yeah, and also...
And it's still used even now. Oh, if people yeah. claim welfare or have been unemployed for a long term or whatever, it's always a bad character judgment.
Yeah, and, I mean, especially now, but even then, someone's, like, life or, you know, potential criminal record prior to whatever crime they're being tried for should not be allowed into the courtroom. And there are laws against that in Scotland. But Lord Guthrie didn't seem to care about that. So the jury took an hour and 10 minutes to deliberate and came back with a verdict of guilty. The jury voted 9 guilty, 5 not proven, and 1 not guilty. And Lord Guthrie sentenced Slater to death on Thursday, May 20th, or sentenced him to die on Thursday, May 27th, 1909.
Have we said before what not proven means?
I think we've, because Madeline Smith was found not proven, right?
I can't remember.
I think so. So basically, not proven is a Scottish peculiarity in the legal system that it basically means they probably did it, but there's no evidence to that. And so if you're found not proven, you're released.
So originally, not proven was actually, it was guilty or not proven. They didn't have not guilty.
Yeah.
And then when sort of court systems were more unified, they added not guilty, but they never got rid of not proven.
Yeah.
So nowadays, not proven is like you say, it's, well, we think you did it, but you can't prove it.
Yeah.
But its technical use is another way of saying not guilty.
Yeah, and basically, with either of those verdicts, you're like, you're cleared of the crime isn't still on your record. Yeah. You don't serve any time or anything.
Yeah, so, it's the same outcome as not guilty.
The end result is the same, but it does... Like you say, especially now, like the sort of connotation of not proven is like, well, they just couldn't prove that you did it,
but we think you did it.
Yeah. And it is still a verdict that can be handed down in Scottish courts today.
Yeah. When the verdict was announced, Slater shot up out of his seat and cried out, "My lord, my father and mother are poor old people. I came on my own account to this country. I came over to defend my right. I know nothing about the affair. You are convicting an innocent man. I came over from America, knowing nothing of the affair, to Scotland to get a fair judgment. I know nothing about the affair, absolutely nothing. I never heard the name. I don't know how I could be connected with the affair." His statement in court got the city's attention, and soon enough many Glaswegians were lining up on the street corners to sign a petition that said the prisoner had not been adequately identified as the murderer and that alleged immoral character shouldn't have been brought before the jury. The petition pushed for Slater's sentence to be commuted. More than 20,000 people signed it. Slater's lawyer sent the petition to the Secretary of Scotland, who commuted Slater's sentence to penal servitude for life 2 days before he was set to be hung.
Lucky timing there.
Yeah.
So Slater was sent to Peterhead Prison, which we've discussed a couple times before, I believe.
Yeah. Angus Sinclair.
Yep.
Served time there, as did...
Didn't Peter Tobin? Or is that...
I don't think Peter Tobin did, or he might have done. No, I'm thinking of Alexander Gartshaw.
Oh, yes.
Who is believed to have killed Moira Anderson in the 50s.
Yes. So.
So yeah, go back, listen to our old episodes.
Yeah. Basically, though, not a fun place.
Yeah, they didn't have electricity or running water in the cells until 2005,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. It's not good.
It was the most notorious prison in the country. It's now been replaced by HMP Grampian.
Yes.
Which is a brand new modern, modern built prison.
Uh-huh. So while he was in Peterhead, he wrote bewildered letters to his lawyers full of theories about what had actually happened to Miss Gilchrist, just sort of trying desperately to come up with something that would clear his name. Meanwhile, William Roughhead, who was a well-known Scottish lawyer and amateur criminologist, was busy writing up the facts of the crime and the case in an early example of true crime writing called Trial of Oscar Slater, which was published in 1910. After the book's release, public opinion again swayed, and many believed that Slater had been the victim of a grave injustice. Roughhead's book convinced many influential people of Slater's innocence, including Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. And in 1912, Doyle published his own work on the case called The Case of Oscar Slater, appropriately, which was a thin volume based on Roughhead's account pleading for a full pardon for the prisoner. And interestingly, Doyle's version of the crime also presented a theory not favored by many at the time. His theory was that the murderer hadn't been looking for jewels or valuables in the flat, but rather some document, perhaps a will, which would explain why the papers were all strewn about on the floor.
I was going to say, that would make a lot more sense, because not like those gold watches and jewels mm-hmm. and things lying around, and they were left fairly untouched, yep. whereas there's papers everywhere.
Exactly. So all these very public pleas for Slater's case to be reconsidered also reached someone very close to the case in the Glasgow police.
Detective John Thompson Trench had begun working to re-examine Slater's case. Trench had joined the Glasgow police force as constable in 1893, and by 1912 he was a detective lieutenant. He had been involved with the Gilchrist case from the moment it was reported to the police. In fact, he said that Nellie Lambie had actually named the man she had seen in the flat the very night of the murder. And wouldn't you know it, the name was not Oscar Slater. But once police found out about the missing brooch, they pursued that lead above all else and became obsessed with Slater. Trench had to follow orders and put aside his own theories and feelings that Slater had been wrongly accused and convicted. But as time passed, his concern that the true killer had never been caught and that the wrong man was sitting in prison weighed on Trench's conscience. In 1914, he approached a well-known Glasgow lawyer, Mr. Cook, told him what he knew about the case, and asked for advice. The lawyer then approached one of His Majesty's prison commissioners for Scotland, who then wrote to the Scottish Secretary, Mr. McKinnon Wood. Wood wrote back on February 13th, saying that if Trench wrote up what he knew of the case, the secretary would consider the matter.
Yes. So Trench sent over all the information and evidence that he had, which set into motion the destruction of his career in the police force. So, Mr. Cook asked Mr. McKinnon Wood to hold an inquiry into Slater's case and raised 5 questions. 1, did anyone on the night of the murder identify the man in the flat as anyone other than Oscar Slater? 2, if they did, were the police aware of this? And if they were, why wasn't this presented at trial? 3, did Slater flee from justice? 4, did the police know that Slater had given his name in Liverpool and had disclosed prior plans to travel on the Lusitania? And 5, did one of the witnesses make a mistake about the date she said she was in West Prince's Street? All fair questions, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think we already know the answer to these at this point.
Mm-hmm. Mr. McKinnon Wood appointed the Sheriff of Lanarkshire to conduct an inquiry into the case. But Like everything else in this case so far, it was hardly fair or balanced. The inquiry was private. Neither Slater nor his lawyer were allowed to attend. The witnesses were not under oath and were simply asked to appear but could decline if they wanted to. The inquiry was supposed to, quote, in no way relate to the conduct of the trial, and the only people present were the sheriff, his clerk, and the witnesses. Oh, and also, the actual words of the witnesses weren't transcribed. Instead, the sheriff dictated a summary of each witness's testimony, and when he didn't like what they had said, he just left that part out of their evidence and put in asterisks instead.
Oh. Isn't that convenient?
Isn't that great?
Most of these asterisks related to the mystery man in the flat, who is known in the report as A.B. According to the records, Detective Lieutenant Trench testified that a superintendent and two detectives went to A.B.'s house the day after the murder, based on information given by Nellie Lambie. He didn't know what happened there, even though he had tried many times to find out. He was then instructed on December 23rd to take a statement from Miss Birrell about A.B. Miss Birrell, who was Miss Gilchrist's niece, had made a very interesting statement indeed. She noted that Miss Gilchrist wasn't on good terms with any of her relatives and never had family visitors. She said Nellie Lambie came to her house the night of the murder and told her she had seen and recognised the murderer. Miss Birrell said that Nellie had identified the murderer as this man, A.B. She was sure of it.
Yeah. So, Trench then recalled bringing up the matter of this A.B. to his superiors, but he was met with resistance. He was told by the chief superintendent that another officer had decided that A.B. had nothing to do with the matter, and there was nothing else they could do about it. And Trench was also convinced that Mary Berriman was nowhere near Miss Gilchrist's flat the night of the murder. And he said that he had taken statements from her employer and her sister saying that Mary had not been out on an errand the night of the 21st. Both Nellie Lambie and Miss Birrell denied this recounting of events at the inquiry. And the other members of the Glasgow police closed ranks and denied Trench's version of the story. The secret inquiry concluded on April 25th, and on June 17th, Mr. McKinnon Wood made a statement in the House of Commons saying that no case had been established which would justify any interference with Oscar Slater's sentence. And on June 27th, the government issued a white paper on the matter, which was looked upon kindly by pretty much only the Glasgow police and nobody else. Trench, for his bravery and attempt to see justice done, was suspended for consulting with a civilian about the case. That would be the lawyer, Mr. Cook. He appealed his suspension to the magistrates, who decided instead to dismiss him from the police force altogether. And when Trench wrote to Mr. McKinnon Wood, who had promised to protect Trench if he blew the whistle, asking for help, McKinnon Wood didn't even bother to respond to his letter.
Be careful who you tell your problems to.
Yeah.
Most don't care, and those that do, most are happy you've got them.
Yes. Yeah. Not a band of loyal folks in this story.
Trench had been in the military prior to joining the police. So when World War I broke out in August 1914, he joined the army. He was well respected in the army and was appointed Provost Sergeant of Stirling, but even though he left the police behind, the police were still thinking about him. In May of 1915, Trench and Mr. David Cook were arrested on the charge of reselling stolen jewellery. It all related to a jewellery store burglary Trench had investigated in January 1914, and the whole accusation was very confusing. If you're interested, you can read more about it in Jack House's book, Square Mile of Murder, which we'll link below. Basically, the Glasgow police were trying to frame Trench for making them look bad, but they didn't succeed. The judge addressed the jury in the trial, and made it clear that the evidence against the two men was flimsy at best, and said that the two men should be found not guilty. And the jury did just that. Trench and Cook were released, and Trench rejoined the army unit. He died at the age of 50 in 1918.
Now, Trench's quest to bring justice to Slater wasn't forgotten after his death. 8 years after he died, Trench's journalist friend William Park published yet another book about the case, this one called The Truth About Oscar Slater, and Park dedicated the book to Trench. Slater, meanwhile, was still serving hard labor in Peterhead Prison. By this point, it was 1927, and Slater had been there since 1909. It was customary in Scotland for life sentence prisoners to be released after 15 years, but Slater was already up to 18 and had no release date in sight. But William Park's book changed all of that. Park's book laid out Trench's theory of the case, which was this. A man whom Miss Gilchrist knew very well had gone to visit her that night. He hadn't intended to kill her, he simply wanted a document from her. They argued, and he struck her, which caused her to fall and hit her head on the coal box. And when he looked at Miss Gilchrist and saw she was still alive, he realized that she would tell Nellie Lambie who had attacked her. So he decided that he had to kill her. He used the chair in the dining room to beat her, and the bell rang, but he ignored it. And then he went into the second bedroom to find the document he was looking for. When he heard the door open, he simply walked out. He knew that Nellie knew him and wouldn't be suspicious of him being in the flat.
A copy of Park's book was sent to the Secretary of State for Scotland, Sir John Gilmore, and newspapers took up a renewed interest in the case. On October 23rd, 1927, Empire News ran a statement supposedly from Nellie Lambie, where she admitted she had known the man she saw leaving the flat, but the police had convinced her she had made a mistake and pushed her to say she had seen Oscar Slater instead. Gilmore was convinced, and on November 10th, 1927, he told the House of Commons, "Oscar Slater has now completed more than 18 and a half years of his life sentence, and I have felt justified in deciding to authorise his release on licence as soon as suitable arrangements can be made." The press wasn't exactly thrilled with his decision, because they saw releasing Slater as a way to avoid looking into the whole case. Slater was released from Peterhead on November 14th. At his release, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle took up Slater's cause once again and sent a letter to all MPs stating that an inquiry into the trial should be made. This time, the Secretary of State agreed and arranged an inquiry to be conducted by the Scottish Court of Criminal Appeal.
And actually, this was an interesting case because the Scottish Court of Criminal Appeal had just been created, basically.
Oh.
But, and it had a cutoff date for cases that it would consider. It was like nothing before 1926 or something, but they made a special exception for Oscar Slater's case.
Oh.
A little bit of,
well, that's interesting.
Legal trivia there.
Yeah.
Slater's appeal was held in the summer of 1928, and when all the evidence was presented, the court found that Lord Guthrie's instructions to the juries had been prejudicial and that Slater's conviction should be vacated. The Secretary of State made an address in the House of Commons saying that Slater should put forward a request for any amount of money he desired and it would be considered by the government. Now, Slater responded saying he wouldn't make any claim for compensation. Despite this, Sir John Gilmore sent Slater a letter saying the government would send him a payment of £6,000, which would be worth about £379,767 today, if he agreed to this amount. So Slater agreed, even though he probably should have consulted his lawyers, because Slater had to pay for the costs of his appeal himself, which cost about £1,500. So, good chunk of that went to his legal costs.
Yeah.
And just like when he didn't listen to his lawyers about not volunteering to go back to Scotland, he just decided to do what he wanted anyway. But
yeah,
it worked out okay. He had plenty of money to live off of after that. So following his release, he lived a quiet life in the seaside town of Ayr on the west coast of Scotland. And Oscar Slater died on February 3rd, 1948. He was 75.
So, what did happen on the night of December 21st, 1908? Who killed Miss Marion Gilchrist? Well, we should tell you that eventually, Mary Barrowman came clean and admitted she had never been in West Prince's Street. She hadn't bumped into the killer. She hadn't seen anything at all. Her alcoholic mother had forced her to tell the story to claim some of the reward money. Nellie Lambie was said to have prepared a statement to be released upon her death, but no statement was ever released. That is a bullshit cop-out. Oh, this man went to prison for 20 years, and I had a hand in it, but I'm not going to tell you till after my death, and even then I won't tell you.
Yeah.
So, the question becomes, who was AB? The man Trench so strongly believed was the killer. Over the years, AB has been identified as Dr. Charteris, one of Miss Gilchrist's nephews. When asked years after the murder if he was AB, Charteris denied it. But who wouldn't?
I mean, I would.
Yeah, especially if there was a lot of money in the family.
Yeah.
Bet he was in there cutting them curtains up.
Exactly.
Finding everything that was hidden inside.
So in the book Square Mile of Murder, Jack House puts forth his theory that it wasn't just Dr. Charteris who had a hand in Marion Gilchrist's death, but that two men were involved. If we look at Miss Margaret Beryl's statement that said Miss Gilchrist wasn't on good terms with her family, we start to see the whole picture come together. So, Marion Gilchrist had inherited a massive amount of money from her father when he died, which was a source of constant strife between Miss Gilchrist and her sisters. And apparently he only left her money. He didn't leave money to anybody else in the family.
I mean, I'd be pissed if I was in that family.
Yeah.
Maybe not murderous.
Maybe not. But
I mean, maybe like embezzlement scheming. But
Now, there's also another little wrinkle here. Marion Gilchrist gave birth to an illegitimate daughter when she was young. I know.
The shame. The horror. Good on you, girl. Get it, girl. Right?
Like, I'm sorry, but living in the lap of luxury with fucking hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of jewelry sewn into your fucking curtains, like, sounds like a pretty good life to me.
Yeah.
So she had had a daughter when she was younger, who she was in touch with, and she had actually employed in her household at one point. So apparently her family learned that she had planned to leave all of her money to that daughter and her granddaughter as well. And as you might imagine, this angered the rest of her family, who all wanted in on her will. So, Jack House proposes that Dr. Charteris had help from one Austin Beryl, which name should sound familiar. And I don't know his relation to Miss Margaret Beryl, who is her niece.
So Margaret Beryl was the niece.
Yeah, so he was...
Dr. Charteris
was a nephew.
Was a nephew, so Austin Beryl is somewhere in amongst that.
Yeah, I think he could either be Margaret's father, maybe? Like, married to one of Marion's sisters, or
yeah,
something like I couldn't find it.
Look, we're all genealogied out, yes, this week, so we didn't trace the family tree
exactly. that's who Jack House thought was the other person involved. And he even had conversations with one of Austin Burrell's nephews, who told him that the whole family knew that, quote, Uncle Austin had done the murder. So how did Burrell and Charteris do it?
Nellie Lambie easily could have let them in. She knew them, after all. Or they arrived right after she left. They knew Miss Gilchrist kept her documents in the spare bedroom, so once they were in the flat, they split up. Burrell took Miss Gilchrist into the dining room, and Charteris went into the bedroom to search for the document. Jack House believed that Miss Gilchrist knew what they were up to and started giving Burrell hell. And Burrell was apparently known to have epileptic fits that would send him into a blind rage, which House believes is what happened next. He struck Miss Gilchrist and she fell, hit her head on the coal box. The sound of her falling and the thud, the sound of her falling was the thud that the Adams family heard downstairs. Realizing that he was in trouble, Burrell decided to double down and started attacking Miss Gilchrist with the chair, which sent blood everywhere.
I do love that it's the Adams family downstairs. The first time I read that, I did a double take.
Adams.
I mean, I'm sure the thing is, like, it's a very common name. I just have never thought about it before. As like,
I mean, it's the name of the first man.
I mean, yes, it is.
Which is pointless and irrelevant to everything in life, but you know,
as most men are. What? Moving on.
Well, let's be honest. But yeah, so it is a popular surname. We just don't think of it as, we don't think of people as the Adams family. No.
It's like, it's that specific description that it's like, oh, it's the Adams family downstairs with Lurch and Cousin It.
Yeah, it'd be like the Adamses.
Yes.
So-and-so Adams. And then suddenly it's the Adams family. Yeah. Oh.
Da-na-na-na. 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 Anyway.
We do not have the rights to that song.
Hopefully my rendition is bad enough that it won't be.
Why do you think I started clapping in the wrong places?
Well, there you go. It's fine then. Anyway, so he's attacking her with a chair, but because Burrell was holding the chair, he would have kept some blood off of his body and his clothing, but he would not have been able to keep it off of his hands. And indeed, William Roughhead had a photograph of the chair in question with a very distinct handprint in blood. Now, we know that the Glasgow police had used some like fingerprinting in previous cases, and also in the case of Jesse McLaughlin.
They used like full footprints then, didn't they?
Because there was a footprint in blood that they then did tests to match with her. So it was not unheard of that they would do that. But they did not use fingerprinting or anything like that in this case, unfortunately. So House wrote that this bloody handprint is why we know that two men were involved. If only one man had killed Miss Gilchrist, there would be evidence of blood in the bedroom and on the documents, but there was none. House surmised that Burrell ignored the bell when Arthur Adams first checked. He threw the rug over Miss Gilchrist's head and left the flat, and instead of leaving the building, he went upstairs to the landing of the unoccupied flat and waited until Charteris was done and the hallway was clear. Charteris found what he was looking for and simply strolled out of the bedroom, past Nellie Lambie and Arthur Adams. And then, with Adams and Lambie inside the flat, Burrell could run down the stairs, and the two men booked it to Charteris's house with plenty of time to compose themselves and change before the police arrived to question them that evening. And that is the story of the murder of Miss Marion Gilchrist, the unfair trial and imprisonment of Oscar Slater, and the last of Glasgow's Square Mile murders.
Wow.
Yeah.
Clearly, it's clearly a case of an unfair trial, of I think anti-Semitism played a huge part
yeah.
in it. Like you said, there was a sort of a mass influx of Jewish migrants to Glasgow at that time, mm-hmm. which, you know, had been preceded by mass immigration from Ireland and Italy.
One of the things that, so this is the last chapter in Jack House's book, Square Mile of Murder. And then he has a little like epilogue and he talks about the four cases and how he thinks that the real culprit here is respectability, and how without the idea of like respectability and keeping up appearances in Glasgow during this time period of 1850s to the 1920s, I guess, basically, like you wouldn't have Madeline Smith killing her, you know, working class lover to marry the fancy man, Billy Minnick. And you wouldn't have her being found not proven just because she's a lady from a nice upstanding family. Like yeah. you wouldn't have what's his name, Old Fleming, being like not even considered to be a potential murderer of a servant, even though he's been known to be like,
even though he was a sexual predator,
exactly, just because he's a well-to-do man. And you wouldn't have the human crocodile going around and murdering like multiple people,
yeah,
getting away with it because he's a doctor.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. That definitely plays a big part. And even sort of the police as we know them today, their very earliest incarnations, it was good character equaled innocence.
Yeah, and I mean, if you think about it, like, police forces, and we're seeing a lot of this sort of history be exposed right now in our current moment when people are talking about defunding the police and dismantling the police establishment as we know it. Police forces were created to protect the upper classes from the quote-unquote riffraff of society.
Yeah, I mean, in America, it was, the police force was born out of the, to protect white people.
Exactly.
Protect in, you know, big inverted commas. Yes.
Also, if you think about, like, basically, Slater was picked as the main suspect because he, quote, lived a life of crime, right? So he was a gambler. He may or may not have dealt in, like, reselling stolen goods. But
he was never prosecuted for that, was
he? No, he had two criminal charges on his record for, like, getting in bar fights where the other guy also had the same charge, and, like, he was acquitted of every criminal charge.
So drunken brawling.
Basically, yeah. But like he had never been in prison or charged with like a violent crime. Like it's something that we see so often of like, well, if someone deals drugs or if someone, you know, gambles or whatever, they must be this horrible person who their character allows them to like commit murder or do all these really violent crimes, when that's perception.
And, yeah, and especially in terms of serial murder, there is usually an escalation.
Yeah.
But that escalation starts as a kid with like torturing animals and things. It doesn't start with bar fights in your 20s.
No.
Leading up to beating the shit out of old ladies and stealing a brooch.
Exactly. And that's the other thing that people speak to a lot about Slater, is that if this man resold like stolen jewels, how the fuck did he resist all of the jewelry just laying around the flat?
And also, if he hadn't been prosecuted for it before, so if he'd been sort of stealing and reselling, or, you know, even if he wasn't stealing himself, yeah. but, you know, fencing stolen goods, How did he make such a big mistake as to leave a paper trail at a pawn shop?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to say nothing of the fact that, like, he pawned that brooch over a month before the murder even happened, but the police still decided, yeah, whatever.
I mean, that's quite impressive.
Isn't it?
That he managed to steal it and managed to pawn it a month before he stole it.
Go back in time. And Oscar Slater, the first Time Lord.
Who knows? Could have been the inspiration for Doctor Who?
He could have. I mean, there's the whole Sherlock Holmes connection with Conan Doyle. And so, you know, you never know.
Yeah. So there was a series on BBC Scotland last year. I think it was called Crime Files with David Wilson.
Yeah.
On BBC Scotland. And they covered this case in one of the episodes. And apparently, so Oscar Slater then went off and lived this very low-key, quiet life, you know, out on the coast and didn't really want anything to do with anyone after he was released. And apparently Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was quite put out by this because he'd, like, fought for justice for him.
Yeah.
And apparently, like, Oscar Slater had, in his view, hadn't been, like, appreciative enough. And, you know, it's kind of expected that he'd go on to be this, like, champion for reform and for, you know, like, the poster boy for, you know, police and justice and things like that. And he was like, I'm tired. I'm done.
I mean,
I don't blame him. He'd done 20 years hard labor in Peterhead prison.
Fuck, right? And, like, yeah, so apparently also at one point Slater had written to Doyle saying, like, hey, you made money off of this book that you wrote about my case. Can you share some of that? Because I need to pay for these legal fees and whatever. And apparently Doyle said, nah.
Yeah.
So there, after everything, there was some bad blood between the two of them.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't blame him. Like,
no.
This is a total stranger making money off his crimes. What do we do again?
Well, we don't make much, so suck out. <yet. laughs>
No, but, you know,
yeah,
he had campaigned and everything on his behalf, but he also made a hell of a lot of money out of it.
Yeah, exactly.
And still wanted more from this guy. And if you'd spent 20 years in Peterhead prison for something you didn't do, with other people making shit tons of money,
I'd be pissed about that.
I'd be so done. I'd be like, I'm going to go live in a hut in the mountains and dig a big moat around it.
Yeah. Yeah. And, like, apparently, you know, he just kind of spent the rest of his life in air. He was well known in the community and, like, people knew who he was and knew his past, and everyone seemed to think he was just a nice guy.
Yeah.
And it's just a shame that he spent all that. I think the thing that really gets me is that he spent all that time in prison, but also there were clearly so many people who knew that he didn't belong there for so many years, and they just didn't care.
Yeah, it's not just that people, it's not just the ones that didn't care, it's the ones that were complicit as well. Like, Nellie Lambie.
Yeah.
Like, she knew for the rest of her life, she knew.
Yep.
But she was like, oh, I'll release a statement on my death. That means that you know something.
Yeah. I think that these four cases are really interesting because they are all pretty similar. In the sense, except for Edward Pritchard, Human Crocodile, whom, like, it was pretty clear what was going on there.
Yeah.
Like, there was a lot of misinformation and a lot of, like, just people getting away with murder, people the wrong people getting, you know, imprisoned for murder.
It was the, like you say, it was the upper echelons being protected.
Yeah. And
when really it's thought they're the people that everyone else needs to be protected from.
Yeah. Yeah. Their power and control over these situations led to the destruction of a lot of other lives. So that's a fun note to end on.
Yeah.
Why do we always do this?
Things have changed. That's a positive.
Yes, yeah.
Things still need to change massively.
Yes.
But, like you say, massive lessons were learned from this case.
Oh, yeah.
Like you say, it's now a teaching point for identity parade procedure. So, if nothing else, that good did come of it.
Yeah. No, definitely.
Peterhead Prison doesn't exist as an actual working prison anymore. That's a good thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the good things came out of it. And thankfully, Slater was released and he wasn't hung for his crimes. So that's something. But
yeah,
still.
Yeah. So thank you, everyone, for listening. Now, we may be done with the Square Mile murders, but we will still be covering plenty of Glasgow cases and Scottish cases in the future.
Yeah.
So if there's any that come to mind that we haven't covered yet, I know we've done a few, but yeah, let us know and tell us on social media.
Yeah.
And if you want to make sure that you don't miss out, subscribe to us. If you haven't already, you'll get notified every time we have new episodes. And if you'd like to give us a rating and review, we would love that because it helps us reach more people.
Yes.
Helps us keep doing this, which we love. We do have new exciting projects that we have in the pipeline.
Yeah.
Hopefully we'll get to next year. We're very excited about. So yeah. Keep it coming. Keep listening.
Yes.
Tell us what you want to hear. Tell your friends. Bully them into listening.
Yes. Yes.
You know.
Go tell your other weird true crime loving friends that there's more of us out here, and we're making multi-hour long episodes per week for them to listen to. So
yes,
have them come check it out. Yes. And if you want to go a step further, you can join our Patreon starting at just £1 per month. All patrons get every regular episode a day early. And we have exclusive Square Mile merch, and we do 2 bonus episodes every month for patrons only. This month, one of our extra episodes is about forensic genealogy and the Bear Brook murders. We just recorded it today, which is maybe why we're stumbling over our words in this episode, because that one was long and involved, but really good. So,
yeah.
If you've heard about that case or you haven't, or forensic genealogy is interesting to you, then you should go check that out. And, you can do that by heading to our website where we have links to our Patreon, or you can go to patreon.com/squaremileofmurder to learn more and sign up.
And, come and join us on social media. We have a Facebook group, we have Instagram. Yeah, come and follow us on some form of social media because we do have something very exciting coming soon.
Yes, yes.
So yes, make sure you're following us, liking us, all the rest. And we will see you soon.
Yeah. So thank you guys for listening.
Yeah. We'll see you Friday, hopefully, for our patrons. And yes, hopefully next Monday we have a very exciting announcement on social media.
Yes, and it has to do with the sort of our conclusion of the Square Mile murder cases and sort of putting a nice little bow on that.
Yeah.
As well as some new exciting endeavors. So
yeah.
Yeah.
Appropriate or insensitive. It depends upon your viewpoint.
Yes, it really does. yes.
All will become clear. We will see you very soon.
Yes.
Thank you all for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.